Great being here. This is a journal. I brought a few copies so people can take a look if you're interested. Just gonna leave them around here. So 20 years ago, I was a newly minted Penn grad, still looking for a job, lots of time in my hand, and during the past years, during my time at Penn, I had really kind of grown in my faith through the Newman Center and all the friendships I made there. It was such a great experience. And as I grew in my faith, my desire to learn in general grew beyond what my majors were. My majors were actually econ and international relations, but I started getting a lot more interested in theology and philosophy and especially in literature. And I started becoming aware of just the depth and the richness of the Catholic tradition in literature, and so many great writers. I discovered that some of my favorite writers fit within the tradition, even though I didn't know that, like J.R.R. Tolkien at the time, and then many others that I got to know after that. But at the same time, I found that there were a lot of Catholic publications and you know, speakers talking about this tradition as something that was in the past. There were obituaries for the Catholic novel and what happened to the great Catholic writers of the 20th century. Why don't we have any anymore? And during that summer, while still looking for my first job, I thought, you know, I've met some really wonderful, really talented people through Penn Newman largely, and why not, you know, bring it together? Let's start a magazine and start, you know, with doing something to change this. And so with all the, you know, naivety and hubris of, you know, a newly and free time of a you know, new grad that doesn't have a job yet, I said let's start a Catholic literary renaissance. And yeah, 20 years later, by the grace of God, here we are. And I am very excited to share with all of you that Catholic literary renaissance that we wanted to happen is happening. The landscape for Catholic culture in the arts and especially in literature has dramatically changed since the beginning of the 21st century. And if you are looking for new writers that are publishing great Catholic novels, poetry, you know, what have you, I could just sit here and have my whole talk give you recommendations of what to read by new authors. So there's a real great wealth of this, and it's really kind of enriching, I think, the culture at large, and so it's something that I'm really, really happy to share with all of you. Now, I wanted to spend just a little bit to talk about, like, why does this matter, right? And in particular, you might be wondering, like, okay, but, you know, literature is great, but what does, you know, why does it have to be Catholic literature? What is, let's say, the vocation of the Catholic tradition when it comes to literature, especially right now? What is its vocation to the culture? So there's many answers to that question, many, many ways in which literature in general enriches us, but I want to focus on one particular aspect of that. And in his book, Theology and Sanity, Frank Sheed makes the point that nothing in creation can keep itself in being, since nothing in creation can keep itself in being, then if we see anything at all without at the same time seeing God holding it there, then we are seeing it all wrong. If we saw a coat hanging on a wall and did not realize that it was held there by a hook, we should not be living in the real world at all. So for Sheed, to see God in all things is not a matter of sanctity, it's a matter of sanity. Without sanity, he argues, we cannot see what he calls the shape of the universe. Because, he says, we do not know anything at all until we see it in this context, until we see its place in the totality to which it belongs. And he gives a great example. He says, the human eye may be very beautiful, but the most ardent lover might find it hard to recapture his emotion if the lady, taking his praise for her eye too literally, decided to present it to him on a plate. So these thoughts are meant to set, that he shares are meant to set the stage for a book about theology, but they also have important literary implications. In a very different way than philosophy and theology, literature is a way of seeing, and good literature of whatever genre must help us see what is really there. That I think is part of what literature does. So, unfortunately, today we have been mired in a materialism that is often an unspoken assumption rather than even a conclusion of reason, and our vision as moderns is often shortened so that not only are we unable to discern big metaphysical realities or something, but even to really see ourselves, to really understand what we are. And so we go around with kind of parts of our psyche chopped off and experience the pain of a phantom limb that we never knew were there in the first place. So with that in mind, the Catholic literary imagination has an important role to play in our world. Now, there's many different ways that you can define Catholic literature. I'm going to, try to keep it simple here. Keeping in mind that there are many caveats that you could bring to what I'm going to say here. But many people might say that Catholic literature is not any one thing and so forth, that you can't even define it. And there may be some truth to that, but I think of Socrates, when I studied some Socrates in college, right? He was always asking questions, saying like, why are you calling all these different things the same name then, right? And he would start questioning you about that. So let's try to give it a name. Let's try to see what brings it together. And I would say that one of those things is found in the word Catholic, right? Which it means of the whole. Something universal, right? And so I would say that is something that Catholic literature can especially do, right? It can help us get this picture of the whole, of all of reality, including the God that underlies it. So to consider basically a literature that kind of chops off God, right, is to kind of forget to look at the whole picture, to really see reality itself. So that can serve as a working definition. But even if we define the term in general, it can still be true that in different times and places, Catholic literature may have a different role to play. So what's its role today? I think that Catholic literature can really help us get over some of the blind spots of our age. And so what would that be? Well, in The Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis points out that those who see through everything have become blind. He says, a wholly transparent world is an invisible world. To see through all things is the same as not to see. So that's a blindness. We become, in a sense, so cynical. We feel like we can see through all things, but then we end up not being able to see anything at all. And this blindness is one that comes about when we take for granted that we live in a flat and disenchanted world. And that can have many distorting effects, and I believe that it's really strongly connected with a crisis of meaning that I think is at the heart of this civilizational unrest that we seem to be living in, when we are, in the culture that in a civilization that by many measures is giving us the best standard of living, right, and well-being that humans could ever imagine. And yet there's this unrest, there's this emptiness, and there's this crisis that we kind of all feel. And not only are we suffering from acute disenchantment, but even worse, with the rise of AI, I think it threatens to bring something like a counter-enchantment. You might call it a hex, in which we treat each other and the natural world as meaningless bundles of matter, And yet at the same time, we start treating bits of code as persons, right? So there's, you know, kind of an inversion almost of enchantment there. And I think Catholic literature can be a very valuable weapon against that. Because the stories we tell ourselves are, you know, much more often than, I would say, the work of scholars even, have the power to shape our understanding of reality. And so when you look at what's called realist literature, which is maybe like the dominant literary approach today, you see a narrowness of vision there that it's you know, the kinds of events that are allowed to be portrayed by realist novels, you often find that the uncanny, the miraculous, the unexplained, all of these things, you know, suddenly get chopped off from these novels as not realist. And those things are by definition, you know, less common, right? They're unusual things, right? But I wanna challenge that idea, because I think if you look at any family history, if you go and ask, you know, your grandparents, your aunts and uncles, your cousins even, about strange family stories, right? You start finding that there's like weird stuff that has happened to the people, you know. Like, I feel like everybody has that. Like in my own family, like there are like some crazy stories. And just to, you know, I'm kind of going long here, so I'm going to try to keep it short, but I'll tell you just one thing. One good example of this is my grandfather. I wouldn't be alive. I don't think any of his descendants would be alive if it weren't for something that I cannot understand in any way other than as a miracle. When he was a young man engaged to my grandmother, he got appendicitis. They didn't catch it in time. It exploded in his abdomen and became this generalized horrible infection. And this was before penicillin. So he was dying. It was you know, too late for him, basically. And the doctors did all that they could with what they had, and they tried to stabilize him. But he fell into this situation where he went weeks and weeks and weeks where he was trying to recover. But he was just getting worse and worse. This infection was so bad that the wounds in his abdomen wouldn't close, so they were like exposed. His insides were literally like exposed to the air, and it smelled horrible when you walked into his room, is what they tell me. And it was so bad that one of the doctors, when they needed to do a surgery on him, they thought that he was out, and one doctor said to the other doctor, you know, why should we do this? Why should we operate on a corpse? And he said, he's like, I'm here, I can hear you. And you know, to make a long story short, after a long time of no progress, and his mom had given, you know, had everybody else except his mom had given up hope, his sister was a Salesian nun. And the founder of their order had just been canonized, and they had brought her relics to Colombia for a tour. And because she was a nun, my great-great-grandmother got her daughter to secure a little piece of this nun's habit. And one day, she goes up to the hospital, and before the doctors could do anything, she took this piece of the habit, as well as a religious medal of Our Lady, and stuck it inside of his abdomen. And the doctors were horrified, literally horrified. And they were just like, what are you doing? You know, if there was any hope, you just killed your son. And she was like, I don't care. You guys haven't done anything. Like, I'm going to do this. And she, I don't know how this happened, but she, either they couldn't fish it out or... but it stayed in there. She got them to keep it in there. Well, a couple of days later, the wounds healed. Like literally, like that week, the wounds healed, and he was all better. And many years later, he got an X-ray, and the doctors were like, he's got some sort of metal thing inside him. What's going on? And my one of my uncles was like, oh no, that's just the medal of Our Lady. And they're like, oh my goodness. So you know, these kinds of things happen. I mean, actually, I'm going to say, here's a, you know, I'm not going to say this is supernatural, but this is a interesting thing that just happened to me at Mass. Right before Father Remy started talking about his concentric circles, you know, you get kind of one of those like after images, you close your eyes and you kind of get an image of what you were seeing. I don't know why, but just before he said that, I closed my eyes and I saw a bunch of concentric circles in my after image. And I even thought of this, I don't know, there's a famous drawing of Dante's idea of the beatific vision. That you have all these angels going, you know, around the throne of God, and it reminded me of that. And then literally right after, he says this thing about the concentric circles of love, and I was like, huh, that's interesting. So these kinds of experiences, you know, many writers are kind of embarrassed to write about this kind of stuff, but it's part of our human experience, and I think. If we don't tell ourselves stories that where this is true, where these kinds of things happen, right, we begin to kind of fall for that anti-enchantment that makes the world flat and meaningless, and so that's, you know, that's a big part of what Dappled thinks is here to do. It's to allow for this kind of bigger understanding of what is real. It's about, you know, there's a big just to close up here, there's a quote that I love from G.K. Chesterton, where he says that we need to have the imagination to see what is really there. And that's the invitation that Dappled Things kind of wants for the world. And I'm really happy to say that by the grace of God, like, we've been part of a small part of a wider movement that is bringing these stories to light. Stories that, as another Catholic writer, J.F. Power, said, have one foot in this world and one in the next. And so I really want to thank Collegium for all its support it's had, because after, you know, we started Dappled Things with many of the people that I knew from Penn Newman at the time, both recent grads, people who were still in undergrad, and even a graduate student, we didn't know what we were doing, but we said, you know what, let's go ahead and try this. And the Holy Spirit, you know, has worked through it and has kept it going somehow. And now with Collegium, we've kind of united, we've come back, we're kind of come back to our roots, and they really have been able to multiply our efforts, and it's been a wonderful experience. So I want to thank Collegium, and I want to thank all of you for making Penn Newman such a great place. Thank you.
That was really cool.